bit of attention here. Thank you. Thank you. Let's get it down to a dull roar. We got a big schedule ahead of us. Have you enjoyed the convention so far, everybody? All right. Excellent. Excellent. Then I know you will enjoy this afternoon session as well. So, welcome to the third general session of the Spring 2006 California Council of the Blind Convention. Okay. To begin, we will have our invocation from Mikhail Avramenko, Russian Baptist Church, West Sacramento. Mr. Avramenko?
Do you have a mic? Yes, I do. Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. I was told that I invited to have invocation before one of the session of blind and visually impaired persons. But I would say I would like to ask you and talk to you as with precious person in eyes of our lovely Father, the God. Before I pray, I would like to read just one short passage from the Bible and tell the short story that I was faced just a few years ago, one of the country, former of Russian country, when I was there with visit with my family and wife. And we visit one of the orphans' home, one of the orphanage home where the people try to survive physically, emotionally, financially. And I was stunned and I was really disappointed when I find out that from 280 children over just one winter survive just few. Just because of neglection, just because of physical problem, sickness, and just not having a simple condition to live as a person, as a physical individual. And one of the person come to us and say, we have a lost hope. I say, what do you mean lost hope? He took from his packet really, really short and used piece of paper and said, that's our last hope. I say, what is this? I even couldn't read it because it was so, looks old, so used. And he opened it and it's almost fall apart. And he said, like 5 years ago, we had received literature that we can read, we can enjoy it. And most of it was different Bibles, children Bibles and other curriculums. And he said, because of orientation in our country, everything was taken away from us. And only one Bible, children Bible, we hide it, keep it in secret. And when we get to the time of struggle in the winter time, and when we see that our friends are dying, they had just one will. They said, when I will die, just put one piece of this book, one piece of the page of this book, with me. And he said, I want who survived. And I still have this will with me, always with me. And I don't know how long I will live, but I still have this treasure with me. And I'm really appreciate, dear brother and sister, that I see the effort in your life here in the United States, effort that is organized so you can come together. You can talk about problem you face day by day, and you have a help from each other, from those who are take care of you. And I really appreciate that you are come together here. I would like to read just one short passage from the book of Psalms. It's Psalms 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in path of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will never I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, goodness and love will follow me in the days of my life, all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Heavenly Father, I thank you that you're not just our Creator. You're not just our Lord, that you're our Shepherd. And I thank you for your loving hand for us. I thank you for your caring for us. That today I will ask your blessing upon those brothers and sisters who come together because they have some problem in their life. They have some limitation. And I thank you that you're looking at them and see how precious they are in your eyes. I thank you for each soul who came to this meeting, to this session. And I ask that your blessing will be upon their hearts, upon their souls, their minds, their bodies. I ask that you bless this session. And those who will speak and lead this session will be your instrument for your glory and blessing of this day. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Mr. Avramenko, for being here today. Yes, and for giving us that story as well. Thank you. Okay, for the Pledge of Allegiance, I now present Jill Kabe, who is the Girl Scout leader for Troop 460 of Sacramento, and she will turn it over to her girls.
Okay, hi, my name is Andy. This is Troop 460 and part of 55. Our leaders are Jill and Michelle, and here.
Hi, my name is Alex.
Hi, my name is Alina.
Hi, my name is Camille.
Hi, my name is Catherine.
Hi, my name is Megan.
Please stand.
Tell them that.
The flag is in our hearts. It's not here with us right now. Salute. Pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Troop 460. You may be seated. Okay.
Please be seated.
Have a couple brief announcements. I guess I missed that comment. I probably don't want to hear it. Okay. But I'll probably hear it later. Okay. Dave Kronk, are you at a mic?
No.
Okay. Apparently he's not. Okay, he is on his way here. Dave wants to make a brief announcement and get some reaction from you. And I'll let him speak for himself.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
From DeMar Travel. Let's hear it for Dave.
Thank you. Okay, we keep getting a lot of people asking, why don't we do a cruise from California? Okay. My question is, first of all, we've got an idea for a cruise that will depart May 11th of next year. It's a 3-day cruise going from Long Beach to Ensenada and back. The price will start off for an interior cabin per person of $525. And for an ocean view would be $565. For that price, that would include the cruise, all port charges, taxes, and government fees, and your gratuities. And, of course, as much food that you can consume in four 24-hour periods. My question to you is, if we get CCB to go ahead and go with this and to sponsor the cruise, how many people are willing to go on a cruise? Let's show. This would be a Friday to a Monday cruise. So with an applause, let's see how many people would be willing to do this. Okay. Because this is something we would love to put together for the Californians here to take a cruise for a weekend, to enjoy themselves, to have a fantastic vacation. And believe me, it is a fun time. Also, real quick, just to remind you guys, to let you guys know, for all those that might be attending the National Convention, we do have a cruise out of Jacksonville, Florida. That is a 5-day cruise going to Key West in the Bahamas. But just keep that in mind. But we would love to be able to do a cruise for California Council of the Blind. Okay? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Dave's cruises are fun. I have to say that. You know, neither of these individuals need much of an introduction, and I'm not going to take their time by giving them too much of one. But I would just want to say a couple things. First, about Dr. Catherine Campisi. Just let me illustrate with a story how much she means to this organization. She, you know, we know that she's the director of the Department of Rehabilitation. We know all this. But she took her time to call me the other day, left me a message and said, hey, you know, I've looked at your agenda. You really should try, if you can work it in, to get my deputy director, Richard DeVelde, here to talk about emergency preparedness. So it's quite obvious. That just illustrates that Catherine is interested in us, not just for the fact that she has to come here to speak to us as part of a job, that she's interested in us because she cares deeply about blind and visually impaired people and all people with disabilities. And similarly, with respect to our other speaker, the Deputy Director of Specialized Services, Tony Candela. Tony and I, we don't always agree, although we agree more than we disagree, but we always communicate. And there's just a line open between us and between he and anyone else in this organization. And it is an incredible breath of fresh air to have Tony on the job. And I think that you're going to find good things are going to be happening on Tony's watch. So let's now hear from both Dr. Catherine Campisi and Tony Candela.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jeff, for the... Is this microphone on? I think it is. Okay. For the nice introduction. And I just wanted to say that we are really proud at the Department of Rehabilitation to partner with the California Council of the Blind and all of our consumer organizations. But I wanted to give you an idea of, I believe, the strength of our partnership. As Jeff said, Richard DeVelde was here yesterday talking about disaster response, of which he's been very active at the state level. A huge challenge, I can assure you. To try to speak to the needs of persons with disabilities. Today, along with me here, there's a number of rehab staff, and I just wanted to recognize a few of them because the work that we do on behalf of all our consumers, and today particularly consumers who are blind and visually impaired, none of this work would get done without our staff who are here and are so dedicated to the mission of the department. In addition to me, I saw come in a little while ago our Chief Deputy Director, Gary Corbara. Where are you, Gary? I know you're trying to hide out there somewhere, but Gary's back there. Next to him in the corner, you guys better watch out. I might just, you know, task you with some stuff that you're trying to hide over there, is Joe Xavier. Joe is our Chief of Business Services for the entire department. And a significant promotion in the last year, year and a half, and is doing just an outstanding job. Pleasure to work with. Joe Smith from Blindfield Services, who supports our BAC and other activities. I saw Mike Cole, head of the Orientation Center for the Blind, here a while ago. Jerry Aracaro, one of our supervisors. Tricia Leitz, one of our rehab counselors. Jan Carmichael is here. Richard Rueda is not here, but he is in Mississippi in training, and I want to let you know, Richard, under Tony's assignment and Jim Armstrong's assignment, has taken on a leadership role in serving transitional youth who are blind and visually impaired across the state, and I think it's really a wonderful leadership role that he's doing. We're moving forward in that area, and it's an area where we need to make an investment early in people's lives. And I probably missed some other people. I know we have a significant number of our Blind Advisory Committee members in the audience. Our community partners, I believe Anita Aaron and Alan Brenner are going to come up and speak for as part of our session. Kevin's here, I know, from SAC Society. Who else did I miss to our rehab staff? Can you, okay. A couple other folks. I apologize, but I just want you to know that our commitment is very strong and deep to all of you. And last but not least, Tony, who, as you heard, is doing a really wonderful job for us. It's a pleasure to work for. I can't tell you how knowledgeable he is about employment issues for people who are blind and visually impaired, as well as the field of rehabilitation. And he's an excellent colleague, in addition to be deeply committed to getting the job done. I wanted to just take a couple minutes and talk about some of the big picture issues, and then Tony's going to talk to you about what's going on in the division specifically. First of all, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the state budget, and I wanted to let you know something that is probably not something we all love to hear, but it is reality. And that is, while the economic picture in California thankfully has improved, the state budget is still in a challenged situation. And the reason, in terms of general fund expenditures, and the reason that is that you will recall a couple years ago, the state made the decision to do some borrowing in order to avoid more deep cuts, which would have most likely occurred in the Health and Human Services area had those needed to be done. And that was borrowing that extended over a multi-year period. And so thankfully, what has happened is, due to the bounce back in the economy, we are able to pay back that borrowed money without further reductions. But it does not mean that there's a lot of available general fund out there for new services and initiatives and staffing and those sorts of things. I think because the economy has bounced back and it's gotten a lot of press, and because of some proposals like maybe some bond measures or proposed increases to the minimum wage, those sorts of things, people have very heightened expectations about the state of the general fund in California. But it is still challenged, and so I think we need to keep that in our mind as we go forward. We are approaching the budget hearing period, and we know that obviously everyone will be speaking to the needs, and we know the needs are many. But I just wanted to share with you the picture from which we work. The department's budget, as proposed in the governor's budget, which came out in January, we are pleased. Again, our goal has been stability over the last years, which is to be able to continue to serve people with significant and most significant disabilities on an ongoing basis. And we have a 3.4% increase in our budget, which equates to approximately an $11.6 million increase for next year. That is modest, but it's an increase. It's not a decrease. It's not a cut, and we're happy about that. Basically, it reflects about the increase is due to the increased cost of consumer goods and services in the Voc Rehab program. It also includes a small 3% rate increase, which is really just a conforming increase that the Department of Developmental Services proposed and was approved in the governor's budget to give to the support employment and work activity programs. They had had reductions in prior years. So really, it's pretty much stabilization. We don't have any more position cuts. We are projected to lose 6/10 of one position due to the fact that it was a position that was vacant for more than 6 months, and there's a government code which then sweeps those away. But really, that's extremely, extremely minute in the department's scope. So we are just very happy to be in a position where we're not losing money, and we will be able to continue our stabilization to serve those two categories of consumers, given the state of the state at this point. The other things that I wanted to talk to you about a little bit were our relationship with the Rehabilitation Services Administration and update you on our monitoring report for 2004, which the department did receive, and particularly our relationship with RSA in light of the fact that the regional offices did close last October 1st, as you all recall. I want to let you know that we have had really outstanding communication and response from the National Office of RSA to date. We have Charles Sadler is the person who's called the single point of contact, our lead liaison for California. And Charles has been available to us as soon as we call him. He has responded to us in a very timely manner with clear and direct guidance, and it's really been a pleasure to work with him. He's going to be coming out, we believe, in July. This year, RSA is really doing more of a get on the same page, review some documents, meet everyone, visit some programs type of review. And so we will look forward to that. And I don't know if he'll be wanting to visit any community organizations. They have a lot to look at when they're out here. But our relationship and their responsiveness has been outstanding in the interim period. California did receive its 2004 monitoring review report a few months ago. And in that, there was one finding which related to, I think I talked about this before, it's called the Comprehensive System of Personnel Development, known more in plain English as our hiring criteria, particularly for rehabilitation counselors. There was a finding that we needed to make changes in those minimum standards for that to meet the federal standard, which we are doing. And there was a recommendation from in that report regarding homemaker closures of the Department of Rehabilitation, and recommending strongly to the department that we move in the direction of getting a better ratio of competitive employment outcomes, particularly for blind and visually impaired persons, and a ratio of homemaker closures more consistent with that of the national average. We knew this. We've been working on it. Tony has continued, and I think his commitment to quality competitive employment will move us in the right direction in this area. We've provided some guidance to our field offices, and so there really wasn't anything tremendously new or shocking in the report. We have prepared a response to that, our corrective action plan, and particularly we're moving expeditiously in the area of the hiring qualifications for counselors. I think I talked about this at the fall conference, that basically what the proposed new minimum qualifications are to have a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling, counseling, and some master's in rehab person, I suspect, out here. Okay. Or a closely related field, which includes special education, various areas in psychology. I can get you the list of the closely related fields. Or if you are in your last year of enrolled in your last year of your master's program in rehab or counseling or the related field, you may take the examination, which is to get into civil service, and in California is an oral interview, be placed on a list but by the time you are hired, you must have completed your master's degree. So we anticipate, because of the significant retirements that we're going to have, that we're going to have vacancies for rehab counselors over an extended period of time. You all know that our supervisors move up from the rehab counselor ranks, and our district administrators come from the supervisor ranks. And very oftentimes, people above that come from those ranks as well. So those of you in the audience who are rehab consumers, those of you who know young people or any age people that want to go to work, that like working with people and are interested in human service careers, please ask people to consider being a qualified rehabilitation professional or a voc rehab counselor, because we believe we will have openings, and we would love to draw in as many people with disabilities to be role models and mentors, as well as quality counselors for our consumers. So we're working actively with RSA, and we'll continue to do that. The other thing I wanted to let you know is just the other day, and Tony's going to talk about this in more detail, but I think it's just one example of the kinds of initiatives we're undertaking. The other day, I had the pleasure of being with Tony Candela, Tony Lewis, one of our blind field services supervisors, and Jim Armstrong, our program manager, at the Social Security Administration Richmond office. And we have now reinstituted our partnership with them, where they have hired six of our blind and visually impaired consumers as teleservice representatives, and we're looking to expand that. So we gave them a certificate. They gave Tony Lewis an award, and it was very positive. And Tony's going to talk more about similar partnerships along those lines. But it's just part of the direction in which we want to go. And last, I'm going to turn it over to Tony, and then we'd like to leave some time for questions and answers. The last thing I would like to ask you all is, I know many of you are aware of this, but to keep in your thoughts and prayers, Gil Johnson, who's our outgoing State Rehab Council member and a very active member of our Blind Advisory Committee, who recently lost his daughter. So, yes. So the rehab family, our sympathies and condolences go out to Gil. And I know that all of you that want to share that sympathy with him, it's well appreciated as well. So I'm going to turn it over to Tony. He's going to give you a lot more details, and then both of us will be here to answer questions. So Tony Candela.
Tony?
Yes.
Before you begin, there's something come up that I have absolutely got to bring to Catherine's attention at the end of your presentation.
Don't go away, Kathy. I would have recognized you.
Well, I know, but sometimes you don't see too well.
More than sometimes.
What do we do now, Kathy?
Oh, yes.
I said, what did we do now, Kathy? I could hardly wait. Okay. She's always so shy about bringing these things to our attention. So. Okay. Okay, Tony.
No, you can go first. She'll be after you.
Kathy, I would have yielded the floor to you now, but they say you're going to come after me. So. And I don't know, but I'm awfully uncomfortable when Kathy Skivers comes after me.
Me too.
Both of us.
First
of all, thank you so much for having us here, and Catherine Campisi is the most wonderful boss ever to work for. And Gary Kuwabara, who is the fellow who asked me all the questions that I don't think that I'm supposed to ask myself, and really makes me so much smarter than I really am. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate that. And to our wonderful staff that's here in the audience, I'm very proud of every one of them. Gosh, there's so much to say, and we're running just a tad short on time. So let me rush through a few things here. Three basic themes, the things that I want to talk to you about. One, employment. Two, community partnerships. And three, consumer relations. And I think I'll start with number three, consumer relations, since Jeff paved the way already. I am so, so happy to work with Kathy Skivers, Danny Kaiser, and Jeff. At the level when I need to hear something, it's usually because there's a problem out there. Otherwise, I don't get to hear about it. But those guys, they call, they communicate, and we get to work on things before they get worse. We get to hopefully intercede in problems that that you are having out there before they get worse. Maybe even we can prevent a few of them from happening. And I consider the California Council of the Blind, as I do the National Federation of the Blind of California, to be very much a working partner with us, and literally our eyes and ears in places where we may not be, but you all are. And that is a very treasured relationship, which I will do my best to maintain, as I know Jeff and Kathy and Danny are. So I appreciate the CCB. Thank you. Give yourselves a hand. Okay, on to employment, and then we're going to finish up with community partners. I'm going to not touch the microphone. We really do hold at the highest level the goal of assisting our consumers to achieve meaningful, suitable, and hopefully very lucrative employment. That's the highest of our orders of business. Everything gets driven by that. As an example, just last week we had a training with all of the Blind Field Services counselors, and our counselor from the Orientation Center for the Blind, Dana Mitchell, also came. And the entire crux of the 2 days we were together were most effective ways of assisting our consumers to obtain employment. And it was strictly about how we ourselves provide job placement, job development services, but it was also even more about how we work with all of the community partners that we have out there, the agencies for the blind, freelance job placement specialists, other entities that all together, along with the efforts that all of you each as an individual have to make to get yourselves ready to go to work and to go to work and to achieve in your careers. And should something happen where you need some assistance, to get that assistance so you can keep on working and growing in your careers. All of that together is a group effort. And what I am trying to emphasize is, in this business of employment, which is so, so very important, let's never let any one of us forget that we can't do it alone. We have to do it together. And that's my main message. So we had this 2-day training last week, which was strictly designed not necessarily to teach anybody how to do anything except how to work as a team. So I think it's kind of like you teach a person how to fish, and they can eat for a lifetime. That's along the lines of what our philosophy is. So helping folks to learn the value of different ways of forming teams, and how those teams can work together, and how we can each combine our resources with each other and get the job done. That's the main message that I would like for our staff to carry on forward. And where we don't have resources, we need to develop them, which is very important. In that line, I want to tell you about a few successes that we've had recently, and it's this pattern of activity that I think we can continue forward in time. It's sustainable, so it's not one of those things where you do it once, you get so exhausted by it, you can't do it anymore, and it's a splash in the pan. We really want activities that we can continue to repeat over and over and over. The basic model is something like this. Somehow, one of us gets in touch with the Social Security Administration, the Franchise Tax Board, Marriott Hotel Chain, Disneyland. We'll just call it Disneyland. Disney. Disney Inc. And recently the Public Employees Retirement System for California, called CalPERS, and other large scale governmental, private, for profit employers out there who tend to hire lots of people, who are big time employers, who you can get what I call multiple hits, which basically means they Social Security hired six of our folks. CalPERS has made a commitment to hire 4 or 5 or 6 of our folks. Franchise Tax Board, the same thing. Marriott has hired folks in their call centers down in the South for quite a while now. They're in the dozens and dozens. Same goes for Disney. And others like that, where the pattern that we followed can be repeated. And basically what it is, you get a hold of, or they get a hold of you, one of these large-scale employers, we immediately contact one of our partners, let's say Sachs Society for the Blind, or the Lighthouse, or the Earl Baum Center, or Junior Blind of America, or the Sensory Access Foundation, or any of our partners that we work with very closely. And we put our resources together, and we see who among all the folks we're working with, all of you, might be ready for or almost ready to take some of the jobs that they have at their disposal. And we work with them. We work out an arrangement with them to take on 4, 5, or 6 of our consumers as their employees, to hire them. This pattern can go on forever, because sharing the responsibility, sharing the effort, sharing the wealth is something that you can do over and over and over again, whereas if the Department of Rehab says, well, we're going to do it all ourselves, or any one of our partners says, well, we're going to do it all ourselves, or sometimes even any of you say, well, I'm going to do it all myself, I don't know that always works so well. I am insisting that every time one of you is out there looking for a job, and that we're connected to you, you're connected to us, that you will have a job placement person helping you out. That's a commitment that I'm asking my staff to honor, because as good as we all think we are, and the best of us need a little helping hand every once in a while. Or as I like to say, that's why in sports you have coaches, because none of us would ever push ourselves as far as a coach will push us. And when you're out there job hunting, it's sometimes hard to push yourselves, because sometimes it gets very demoralizing out there. And I want you to sustain your effort just as much as I want us to sustain our effort. So again, teamwork is the important thing. Okay, enough about that. A couple of quick statistics. Blind Field Services Unit is part of the Specialized Services Division. The division has now existed since July, officially in July of 2003. And the division is composed of the blind units, and then we have our Deaf and Hard of Hearing Service within the division. Among the blind units, we have our Blind Field Services, which is the thing that you know the most about. That's where our counselors who are in field offices reside. And then we have our Orientation Center for the Blind, Mike Cole. And Jim Armstrong is the program manager for the Blind Field Services. And then we have our Randolph Shepherd, or our BEP, Business Enterprises Program. And John Westbrook is the head of that. And we have our Title VII program for older blind adults. And Joe Smith is the head of that program. And those things compose what I call our blindness services. There are about 75 counselors in the Blind Field Services Unit. Mike Cole has about 31 staff members in the Orientation Center. The BEP folks have about the same number. And Joe Smith has one analyst under him, and he runs the whole darn thing all by himself for the older blind program. Somewhere along the way, I think anywhere between 7 and 10,000 blind and visually impaired people go through our caseloads in a given year. Enters, gets served, leaves, applies for. We have, since the establishment of the Specialized Services Division, endeavored to do one thing more than any other thing, and that is get the number of people who are going through our services into jobs, get that number to rise. Okay, so this year I put the highest goal that the unit will have achieved as the goal for Blind Field Services, and that was to get 400 people employed. And projecting, we have one more quarter of our fiscal year left, but projecting forward, it looks like if everything goes okay, we're going to have 404 people employed. That will be our new record, and that will be our new yardstick for any of the staff out there. You know, we we can't rest on our laurels too much. But that's going to be, if we get that record, then that becomes our yardstick for the next year. And we just have to keep pushing up the number. Now, there is one little thing that I want to ask of you, the consumer organization, and I will ask it of the other one too, which is that if you know people who need our services but for some reason are hesitating to apply, either they don't think they're going to get good service, or they think they're going to have to wait a long time, or they're just not sure that we can help them in any way, we want you. So apply for services if you need us. We want you. Okay, let me shift over to the last of my themes. This is the community partnership theme. You've already heard me start to talk about how we need to be team members. I have thought, and this was when I was working for Gil Johnson at American Foundation for the Blind. My old buddy is doing okay. I have emailed back and forth with him. He's holding up fine. He's thankful for all the emails he's gotten, by the way. He's gotten plenty of them, and he says to say thank you and to say hello. When I was working for Gil at AFB, I had a lot more time on my hands, it seems, than I do now, for one thing. I was working for the private sector, and I was thinking private sector in my own mind at that time. I said to myself, you know, we have a lot of agencies for the blind around the state, and they do get together and talk to each other once in a while, but wouldn't it be really cool if we could just gather all of the agencies for the blind in California together on this one issue, employment, just on that thing? You know, every agency, private, not-for-profit agency that's ever opened in this entire country has basically had a similar kind of history. There is somebody who has a vision, a dream, somebody who sees a need in the community. Maybe a group of blind people have gotten together and they've put together an agency, and every agency has its own traditions, its own specific mission, obviously its own building, its own territory, and so what you can expect out of private not-for-profit agencies is a degree of pride in their work, a little bit of territoriality here and there. Sometimes they protect their own. They have to fundraise to keep afloat. So there's a lot of pressure. I said, let's for this one thing get together on employment. And I had a couple of people saying it at the same time as me. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we formed, and then I want to introduce to you two of those individuals. I'm going to yield the rest of my time for these two individuals. What we decided to do was form something called the California Blindness Employment Coalition, CBEC. And it's just a loosely affiliated group of these agencies for the blind and the Department of Rehabilitation to work together on this one issue, employment. And essentially what our thought was, let's see what we can do to draw in as many jobs as possible. Let's see what we can do to work with some national organizations that might be able to help us draw in even more jobs. Let's see what we can do to make sure that if by chance an employer out there says, I'll hire six of your people, that we actually find six of you to fill those job positions with. Let's make sure that if we need somebody to get some quick training on something because they need to have that training so they can take the job, that we have somebody ready to provide that training out there. Let's make sure of a whole bunch of things that you have to make sure of when you aggressively go out there to seek employment for your consumer base. Let's make sure that we never go wanting for the people, for you, to fill those positions, and that we never go wanting for the training that we need to give you or to help you to get so that you can take these jobs. Because, you know, to paraphrase an old expression from the civil rights era, a job is a terrible thing to waste. So we formed the CBEC, the California Blindness Employment Coalition, and I would like now to introduce two of the co-chairs who are going to come up and say a quick few words, take a few questions, and then Kathy Scarvers, I know, has something that she wants to do. So I would like to introduce, from the Lighthouse in San Francisco, Anita Aaron, and from the Earl Baum Center, Alan Brenner.
I've never had feedback as applause.
Hey, Alan, are you here?
Yeah, I want people to know we're squeaky clean.
Right.
No, only she is. You're not.
Right. Okay. I want to know how many people in this room
would actually be seeking a job if it were a good job.
Yeah.
That's kind of encouraging and depressing all at the same time, isn't it? Why aren't we all working now? And the reason we're not all working now is because we can't find jobs. So what a group of agencies decided to do was to get together and form a coalition to be able to create some job opportunities for people. And that's what we're about. We've got some principles, like they're going to be meaningful jobs, appropriately paid. They're going to look at the skills and interests in the community, what it is we believe we can do, what we're trained to do, and to try to develop some job opportunities around that. So we just wanted to personally give you the message that if you want work, we'd like to be able to be part of a team to help you find that work. And I'm going to hand the microphone over to Alan, who's going to lead us in a cheer or something. I don't know.
Can you elaborate, Anita, please? How will you do that?
Well, one way is to look at whether we can build actually some employment opportunities within our own agencies. For example, get contracts with government agencies and that kind of thing. So like the Social Security jobs, to identify types of work that if we can't get the employers to hire us, perhaps we can get the contracts to do the jobs ourselves and we will hire you. So it's both sides of the coin. Anybody else? Alan, anything you want to add?
Well, I think a lot of us probably have felt and do feel frustrated. We're frustrated that we may be ready to work, we may be interested in working, and we may want to get off this system that sort of holds us back. And yet, when we go out for employment, for interviews, et cetera, there's always a better candidate. We hear this, we experience a lot of things, and it gets a little bit tiresome. So from our perspective, from the perspective of all of the various agencies that are involved in this, and it's throughout all of California, we are determined to do all in our power to make employment opportunities available by not necessarily going out to various places where a job may be offered, but again, as Anita said, by just creating the jobs ourselves. We're not trying to be insulated, we're not trying to be insular, but we need to have people employed, and that's really the bottom line. And we need people to be able to earn an appropriate income and to have the independence that we all strive for and that we all claim that we want and really require in order to live fulfilling lives. So it's our role and it's our goal to cooperate with one another as agencies, as individuals, to cooperate and work very closely with the Department of Rehabilitation and others to make sure that any job that we can bring forth that is a good job for people who are qualified to do it, that we will fill those jobs. So if there are any questions, we're happy to answer them. One thing that I would like to say, this is not a hypothetical long-term plan. This is something that's happening as we speak. One thing that we just got a brief announcement about, there's a need for medical transcribers right now. Plus, there's a potential for additional medical transcribing instruction that it would be available, perhaps an online program. So if you have skills in those areas, notify us. We would like also, and we're trying to work out a way to do this, we want to start collecting resumes. We want to find out what kind of work you want, find out such questions as, are you available to relocate if the job comes along that's appropriate? And we will share those amongst all of the participating organizations and agencies and make sure that you have the best shot possible. So if you'd like to send resumes to us today or anytime, you can send them to Anita at the Lighthouse. You can send them to me. We're going to share them all amongst everyone participating. So it doesn't matter where it goes because we will all be working collaboratively. And that's the same with Tony. I'm sure that Tony would pass them on the same way. So
yes.
Yeah. So if you have any questions for Anita or for me, please don't hesitate to ask. And we really hope that we can help the Department of Rehabilitation and others change what we've been seeing for way too long. So thank you.
Thank all of you. Thank you, Tony.
Where's
Thank you. I think this coalition is an outstanding idea, and boy, do we need it. So that is great. Okay, wait, we will try for some questions at the end, but first I want to recognize Kathy Skivers.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I'm going to address this to all of you, but I'm going to address it especially to Catherine. Catherine and I have had a chance to work together quite a while on the Blind Advisory Committee. But even before she became a director, I had the opportunity to meet and talk with her. Catherine, you know, I've heard a lot in the last few days, and they somehow lately want to tell me how long I've been around, as if I didn't know. Anyway, I have been in many chairs, and you knew me when I was president of the council, but right now, one of the chairs I have is to be the awards and history person for the California Council Blind chairperson. And on a committee I have Roger Peterson, Bernice Kandarian, Gussie Morgan, Al Gill, Don Queen, and Joe Smith. If I've left anybody out, I hope they'll tell me. Anyway, many of us know you. Some of the people that can't see you too well, most of us, don't maybe realize that you're in a wheelchair. And I've met many directors of the Department of Rehabilitation through my life, and I probably had more meetings than most. And I have been troubled many times because although they had disabilities of their own, sometimes a director of the Department of Rehabilitation would only recognize the group that they, you know, whoever had the same disability they did. Catherine Campisi has never done that. She has an open door, an open policy, and I enjoy talking with you. And I always admire the fact that she knows I tell it like it is. At least I tell it the way I think it is. And she does the same. She can tell you just as well. I don't know if that's because we both come from St. Louis or because we're both Catherines or what it is. But anyway, she is a person that listens. And what's better than listening, she hears when you tell her that people are having trouble. And she believes in the disabled community. She believes disabled people can work just the same as anybody else. She has faith in us. And she is a tremendous example. It's a pleasure to me to hear Catherine, and she whizzes around her office in that chair of hers, and she knows what's going on with everything. She is courteous, she's interested, and she has a terrific sense of humor, and I don't know how she could have that job without having a sense of humor. She has been very cordial to this organization. She comes and visits us, and she listens to us, and she lets us know what's going on and helps us. And, you know, there are a lot of, Catherine, as you know, we have the DOR and the CCB and the NFB and the AIB and all of the letter things. If we had an award that we would call the CDC, you'd probably get it, because that would go to somebody that has commitment and dedication, and you care. That's the thing I've noticed most about you. Before Catherine Campisi came in, and I met with many directors and other leaders in various departments, if the hot air that was disseminated could very well be responsible for global warming, I'm not sure. But you never get that. When you talk to Catherine, you ask a straight question, you'll get a straight answer. And if you tell her somebody's in trouble, she really is right there. And Catherine, also, for those of you who don't know, her mother and father-in-law are good members of this organization, Keith and Joanne Black. And she's married. She may know more about blind people than most, because she's married to a blind gentleman named Ralph Black. Catherine, for many reasons that we don't have time for me to go into, I want to tell you we have various kinds of awards in this organization. We have one called Special Achievement Award, and we awarded it only once, and that went to John Burton last year. And today, on behalf of the California Council of the Blind and its members, and I'm so glad I'm still here to be able to do it, we want to award you with a Special Achievement Award from the California Council of the Blind. And Catherine, I have two of my deputy directors with me today. They are called Eric and Daryl Skivers. And my one deputy, Eric Skivers, is going to read for us and present to you a plaque that we have for you. Eric?
I am going to do that indeed. This well-deserved award reads as follows. It says, California Council of the Blind Outstanding Service Award to Catherine Campisi for her outstanding leadership in her unique position connecting the State Department of Rehabilitation to the disability community and her willingness to listen to and serve the diverse needs of the various populations within that community, including the special needs of the blind and visually impaired consumers, recognizing that one size does not fit all. Presented this 8th day of April 2006 in Sacramento, California.
Thank you. Take it to her, Eric.
Thank you. Well, I think this is one of the few times, and Ralph, who's here, will attest to that I'm totally speechless. So, well, maybe not totally, but almost speechless. Kathy, I don't know where you are, but I'll find you to give you a hug. But all of you, thank you so much. I don't know what to say. I really don't feel that I deserve this kind of an award, but I greatly appreciate it. Life makes odd turns. I became disabled when I was 10, and as I grew up, obviously, I attained a passion to make things different in the world for all people with disabilities. And then some nearly 20 years ago, I did encounter and become permanently attached to Ralph Black, as you heard, who, I have always had a passion for all people with disabilities, but obviously Ralph and his family have taught me a great, great deal about the needs and talents and abilities of people who are blind and visually impaired. And I believe I carry that passion for all people, but there's nothing like personal experience for you to learn. And so the partnership with all of you has been wonderful, continues to be wonderful. I think, as Tony said, and Jeff said about Tony, I'm not sure who said about who, we may not always agree, but we share the same mission. And it's a great journey we're on together. And I'm really thrilled to see Tony's work with Anita and Alan and all of you. And as we said, we want to give people with disabilities the dignity of work and independent living. And I so much thank you for the appreciation. Thank you very much. I truly am speechless. Well, not quite.
I think you want to stay in the audience so you can be surprised. I think that was
okay. I'm not surprised. I'm stunned. So thank you very much.
Now you really get to ask the tough questions. You know, you've got her at a disadvantage here.
I think Tony Candela should acknowledge that I don't always be bad.
I know we're running behind, but we do want to have time for a couple questions.
You got Margie.
Margie, you are first.
Thank you. Well, first, am I on?
No.
You can't hear me. I'm not on.
No.
Well, thank you. And first of all, Tony and Kathy, you guys are a heck of a team. And I have all the confidence in the world that our dreadful employment situation of blind and visually impaired people in California will be turned around, which is just wonderful. I would like a point of clarification, and that's regarding the hiring of rehab counselors or similar people in the field. Is that for the rehab counselor jobs, or is that also for the counselor teacher jobs, or is the state looking at implementing a policy where only people that are rehabilitation teachers for the blind will be hired for CT positions so we get the same quality?
Okay, let me try to take a stab at this, then Tony can correct me if I say something incorrectly. Right now, there is one classification, which is senior vocational rehabilitation counselor, okay? Some of those people serve consumers who are have homemaker as their goal. So this would apply to all of those people. Should someday the classification of rehabilitation teacher be explored, that would be a new development. Right now, everyone is a senior vocational rehabilitation counselor.
Okay, do we have Dan? I guess you're the last question. Yes, yes. We are recording.
Yes. I have a vocational question to ask, but I personally have dealt with Catherine during SB 105 and was behind the scenes during the whole thing. And I know, and you know, in my heart, I know how much she advocated for the blind, even when the rest of the world, it didn't look like the rest of the disability community were advocating for us. In fact, we had quite the opposite experience, but we knew Catherine was there. She proved herself, and I think it's well deserving your award. So, my question is why can't blind and visually impaired people go to a regular vocational school and have accessible materials in a vocational school? Like you see those things on TV, and they're federally and they're subsidized too by state government. Why can't we have access to that? Thank you.
The answer is there's no systemic reason why not at all. What generally we get into are problems of what we call program access, and that's where it's going to take a lot of effort on the part of the people who do the same thing, by the way, when somebody gets onto a job, going and making sure that there's accessibility, making sure that the instructors at these places understand that there are alternative techniques that need to be used if a blind person is to be given even half a chance to function, that they need to welcome those students just like they do anybody else. It takes a team effort, just like all of the other things we've been talking about. So I think that the answer is there's no reason at all. The typical thing that happens is when people start adding up all of the effort that would be required to go and do this, they tend to throw their hands up in the air and say, oh gosh, that's terrible. I don't want to put myself through that. And so our job as rehab professionals is to encourage all of you to figure out what your heart's desire is first, to figure out whether that heart's desire from an employment perspective is something that, all other things being equal, is achievable, such as there is indeed a job market for your heart's desire out there. And then comes the process of developing the skills that you need and for us to develop the intervention strategies that we need in order to make these programs that have, for the most part, been less accessible to us than they ought to be, to make those programs accessible. So it's doable. It's a lot of work. But the short answer to Dan's question, there's no reason at all why we can't do it.
Okay, thank you very much, both Tony and Catherine. Boy, the awards committee sure did know what it was doing this time. Man, that is great. I want to make a couple announcements before I bring on Frank Welty for our nominations committee report. First, I want to recognize two people that I actually haven't seen, although one was close to me up here. We have our bill, as Dan talked about last night, SB 1114, on board of directors' requirements for blindness agencies that seek public funding. And I want to recognize both Kevin Duggan of the Society for the Blind, who I see far more frequently than I do the other person, Anita Aaron, for the Lighthouse for the Blind. And because both of them came out in support of our bill, and I just want to personally thank them for doing so. So. Okay, and I want to also mention, on a much sadder note, that the reason I am presiding today was, unfortunately, Rhonda and Lonnie King had to return to Sacramento and then beyond. Her father is going into hospice today, so she is not able to attend the rest of the convention. She sends her deepest regrets at not being here. You know how much Rhonda loves CCB convention. So we will see her next time, without a doubt. Okay, I now turn the mic over for a nominations committee report to Frank Welty.
As most of you realize, CCB has a total of 15 members in its leadership team. It's officers and board of directors, the president, vice president, first vice president, second vice president, secretary, treasurer, and nine directors and one immediate past president. And each year, seven of those positions come up for election. This year, the seven positions that are up are president, first vice president, treasurer, and four board positions. Last night, the CCB nominating committee met to select a slate of candidates that will run for election this coming fall. Of course, other individuals are free to run from the floor at the time of those elections this fall. The nominees are as follows. For president, Jeff Tom.
I kind of agree with that last sentiment.
Boy, I'm glad they weren't this tough last night. For first vice president, Mitch Pomerantz. For treasurer, Peter Pardini. For directors, Artis Bazin, Gabe Griffith, Lewis Preston, and David Jackson. This concludes the nominating committee's report.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. You know, there are some things that, I don't know why they haven't happened years and years ago. And one of them is hearing about a center that, at its inception, was, I think, light years ahead of its time and continues in many ways to set the pace for blindness programs of its particular type. I mean, we've all, or many of us have known about it for a long time. Some of you are alumni, of this center. Let's hear from our speakers today, Samir Shaibi, Living Skills Instructor, and Patty Maffey, Program Director of Students for the Living Skills Center for the Visually Impaired in San Pablo.
Some of you have heard of the Living Skills Center. I could tell from the response. Hey, Julia. Hey, Brooklyn. Some of the graduates are out there. So I just want to remind you that we exist. Tell all of you who don't know about us that we're out there so that you can tell others who tell others who tell others, because it is a very innovative program. And we want to dispel some myths that we've heard about the Living Skills Center. We want to tell you what makes us different and why we are successful. It's awesome, Julia says. We're going to let our graduates speak and our current students speak. And then, you know, you'll know the real thing here. I'm just the program director. And we're also going to tell you what's new, because we got some great things going on. Very briefly, we're a private nonprofit. We're in San Pablo, which is in the Bay Area. We've been in existence since 1972. And we were formed on the premise that people who are visually impaired sometimes need some extra transition skills to be able to transition into the community to living in independently and working. Our students, one of the things that really makes us different is our students are living in the community. They're learning to live independently by actually living independently in their own apartments. So we are housed in an apartment complex that has about 75 apartments, and our students live in seven of those apartments. They each have a roommate. So they're infused in the community. The instruction occurs in the apartments with their own food that they have purchased and their own kitchen equipment. And it's one-on-one instruction. And the other, obviously, orientation mobility occurs in the community, and that's one-on-one instruction also. The curriculum includes living skills, which is cooking, cleaning, care of clothing, orientation and mobility. Our adaptive technology lab, I've been told by a few rehab counselors, is the best in the state. We have up in, we try to stay cutting edge, and the wonderful thing is people get to try all kinds of hardware and software and decide what works for them. And all of the goals, first when the students come, they're assessed, and we only teach to what they don't know. All the goals are individually set, and the students set their own goals. So who can come? People who are 18 years of age and older, visually impaired, and I'll tell you what's new, but currently clients of the Department of Rehab. There is no upper age limit. We've had people in their 70s. So anybody who needs our services is welcome to apply. Okay, I'm going to be the first myth buster. I have heard from people out in the community, they think that we don't allow blindfolds. That's absolutely not true. We encourage blindfolding on an individualized basis for people that would benefit from that. So it's not a standard thing that everybody's blindfolded, but it is something that we do incorporate into our program. So that's myth number one. Okay, I'm going to pass you on to Samir because he has some wonderful things to say, and he's going to talk to you about why it works.
Hi, everyone. My name is Samir Scheibe, and Patty has asked me to speak to you all today for a couple of reasons. One, I was a client of the Living Skills Center, and when I was starting to lose a lot of my sight and kind of changing chapters in my life, the Living Skills Center was essentially my savior and allowed me to keep going and be a productive, independent individual while still being visually impaired. I became so impressed with the program that I kind of wouldn't go away, and I wound up being hired on as a evening supervisor for a few years, and stuck around there and became infused with the rest of the staff and really if I didn't before as a student which I did, but it really shows even more now as a staff member how much this program works, and you know, when the students come through, it's only a 1-year program, but I get to see it year after year after year, young students come in and scared and not having a whole lot of life experience, and when they leave, well, they don't want to leave, and it's amazing the change in their attitude, in even in their body posture and their demeanor. They're much more confident, much more able to take those steps to become an independent person who can contribute something to the community. So I'm going to explain very quickly why the program works, what's special about it, and so what makes the first thing that makes it work is we have a certain expectation. We at the Skills Center, we raise the bar, if you will. A lot of people come in not knowing how to do anything. Some come in knowing how to do already a lot. Our job is to fill in the gaps. But whatever it is that you don't know how to do, we're going to teach it to you. And it's our expectation that you will learn it. And if it takes one time or two time or three times, then that's what it takes. But eventually, you will learn how to live independently and how to do all those things that you would normally have thought impossible. Also, what makes us work so well is that we encourage people to don't worry about the mistakes. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. That's how you learn. And when somebody dumps a dozen eggs on their floor at 2 o'clock in the morning, those are real life consequences. And that's a mistake. And maybe in the future you'll be a little more careful with your eggs. There's very real consequences to all the actions that you take. And I guess transitioning to that would be we all have a very much a can-do attitude. The whole staff, we deal with not only visual impairments but people who are multiply disabled as well as being visually impaired and blind. And our attitude is where there is a will, there is definitely a way. And I always I've probably said to a few students, if you need to stand on your head to vacuum because that's what it takes, and then we're going to teach you how to stand on your head and vacuum. Thank God it hasn't come up yet. So essentially, those things are really what makes us different. This is a very, very special organization. I was really kind of in a lost point in my life when I stumbled on their doorstep, and I've felt such an incredible energy, and I hope that as now a Living Skills instructor, I can give that wonderful energy back to others. I'm going to pass along the microphone to Brandy Getz. She is a current student at the Living Skills Center, and she's going to tell us about a couple things.
Oh. Hello, everyone. As mentioned before, my name is Brandy Getz. I'm 20 years old. I've been at the Living Skills Center since the end of June, and I'll be leaving in June. And so my year will be up in June, and that's a little scary. So, a few things I want to talk about. Why the Living Skills is different from a lot of other programs. The first thing is that most people receive their financial support from Social Security income, and you are required to pay all of your living expenses with that Social Security income. You're basically required to pay for everything. You have to pay for your bills, your electric bill, your phone bill, your rent, your groceries, whatever else, other expenses that you may have. You and a roommate live in apartments, and you are, you know, supposed to help yourself out. Sometimes we help each other out, but most of the time we pretty much are independent and do our own thing. Another way that Living Skills is different from any other program is, well, not any other program, but a lot of other programs, because I'm not sure what's all out there and what they all do, but at Living Skills, you can take the classes, just the classes, or you can go to work, or you can go to school at the same time that, you know, or, you know, while you're taking the classes at Living Skills. And that's kind of nice because it lets you sort of transition out into the community and, you know, get to know the people at your school, at college, or get to know the people in your workplace. And currently I'm involved at the internship at the Lighthouse intern program, working in the adaptation store, and I start next week. So, thank you. I didn't expect that. Another thing that's different about the Living Skills Center is they treat you as a whole. All of your needs are met together. It's sort of like a big team that's sort of rooting for you and helping you out along the way. And the really nice thing is the mobility teacher doesn't always just teach mobility. They kind of get they kind of fuse together and sort of help you out along the way. For example, you need help with something to do with your bills, they can help you with that. Or if for some reason you need help with grocery shopping, you know, that they help you with that. Even though that's something that Living Skills would do, the mobility teachers can help you with that too. And that's really nice. I have to say, in closing, that Living Skills is one of the best programs that I've ever been to out of a lot of programs. It's spectacular. I've learned so much since I've started, and I'm really quite proud of the woman that I've become since I've come out of there. And now I would like to thank you for listening to me and introduce you to Cody Cullum. He's another student, and he has been here since August, I believe. So here's Cody.
Thank you much.
Thank you much. Good afternoon, folks. My name is Cody Cullum. I'm a 8-month, I should say, student. Yeah, my rookie status has got me looking ahead. I'm an 8-month student of the LSC, and I wish to embark a little bit upon the elasticity of the program, which contributes to the potential for greatness and success among the students, at least I've found anyway. Life is not something that is composed into a number of trials. It's not, everybody knows that. It's not written in a book. It's not something that you follow. It is ever changing. It goes up and down. Schedules are in and out all over the place. And you could say that the LSC curriculum is based a little on that style. Everything changes. It's not a set number of classes. The classes are all different at different times. Now, each week, every Monday morning, the staff will sit down and they take a look at the schedules and how they're going to go about placing different students into different time slots to work with different teachers on different subjects. Okay, and this tends to suit people's needs for two reasons. First, it's like Brandy said, you are able, as a student, as I do, to go to school. You're able to hold a part-time job, and aided and abetted by the training that the staff gives you. Now, that transpires into the second reasoning here. The fact is that these teachers, extremely compassionate, extremely knowledgeable people, right, Samir? They are skilled in many, many, many different fields, from financial aid to technology, braille, daily living skills, all the fields that are required whether you are disabled or not, so as to succeed in the world. And you have an upper advantage, you have an upper hand, I should say, on these subjects now, because you are able to basically function just as normally as anyone else. And in that sense, life itself drives the curriculum of the LSC. Now, we have the life-driving experiences, but how do we go about making them happen? Do we actually get out into the community? Well, some people, unfortunately, I've heard these rumors circulated. I do not mean to point fingers, but we have heard it, said, the Living Skills Center doesn't really let you get out into the community. All someone would have to do is follow me every Thursday afternoon to the Lighthouse in San Francisco, or to my college just around the corner, which involves the commute of bus, BART, etc. Anyone who's been in the Bay Area, and I'm figuring quite a few of you out there have, know of the extensive and, compared to other cities, reliable transportation systems. So, the importance of being able to get around and being able to, go any place you want, any place you need to get things done. That's the entire goal set by yourself and by the curriculum with which you are involved here at the LSC. So, and again, the teachers being extremely skilled in the field of mobility, it's no less a task there for them to teach you exactly how to do it. So what does this all transpire? The elasticity of the program and the mobility training in question. It's going to up your confidence, folks, no matter who you are. You could come in here, I guarantee it, and you could see the most skeptical of cases coming in here going, I can't learn anything. I come from an environment where I couldn't get around, and I couldn't find any way to make things happen for myself because I can't see, because I don't have a car, I can't get places, I can't do things. Take it from me, I come from a similar environment. So what it comes down to is that when you see such, great opportunity in front of you, and you feel that exhilaration when you're starting to travel, and you couple it with these great people who are able to teach you all the things that you've always wanted to learn, some of whom are in your boat, some might be visually impaired, blind, it really gives you a sense of freedom, of well-being. You feel like a completely new person rather than just a caged animal or a caged bird. And it just makes you really, really want to better yourself as a person, to get out there and experience what life is like. So I do encourage any of you who have not, who have either heard about the Living Skills Center or might have cruised by it, please research it some more, stop by, take a look at the facility, examine what we do. You will not be disappointed. Well, what do I know? I'm going to turn the mic over again to someone who definitely knows. That's Patty Maffei, and she'll let you know what is new with the LSC. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. It's hard to describe our program when we all feel so compassionate about it and keep it down to a half an hour, so we're trying to talk really fast here. What's new at the Living Skills Center? Since we have put up our website, we are getting requests from people in Canada, Japan, Virginia, Nevada, all over, to open up our program to people outside of California. In the past, we've not been able to do that, but we are now accepting applications from other states. So that's new, and that's very exciting for us. So anybody you know in another state, tell them we're accepting applications. The other thing that's fairly new, and Brandy touched upon it a little bit, and we've always tried to be friendly with other agencies in the community. We are trying to coordinate with the Rose Resnick Lighthouse, the Sensory Access Foundation, to get our students some work experience, some very, very badly needed work experience. And we are thrilled that these programs are open to our students while they're at the Living Skills Center. So that's another thing that's new, is that we are working very hard with other agencies in the community to try to transition people into the employment, into the area of employment. We do a lot of pre-vocational stuff at our agency, getting them ready for employment, learning the technology skills and so on and so forth, and now they're actually able to get some introductory work experience, and we're just very excited about that. So I want to thank you all for listening to us and for having us here. Please talk about us. Go out and tell everybody we're a really great agency, and we're here. Don't forget about us.
Thank you.
Yes, give us your website.
www.livingskillscenter.org. Thank you.
Thank you, all of you. That was a very impressive presentation, was it not, everybody? You were going to put your two students into sales for CCB because... outstanding. We have time for perhaps two questions. We're running a little late, but... Okay, well, we'll take the first two. I'll give... Edna, and then I guess Elmer, maybe? I'm not sure.
I'm Edna Young, Bayview Chapter, Oakland. I have to say for Patty that a lot of you here remember Greg Scott. And and the Living Center is the place where Gregory hit the ground and started running when he left. He was a young man who came from Florida, and he was kind of mixed up and didn't know what to do. But I can tell you, Patty, after being at the Living Skills Center in San Pablo, he hit the ground and ran until his death. And he was used to come here all by himself.
Yeah.
So it is a good place to go.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Elmer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm Elmer Chapson. I've been around longer than dirt, and when I was a counselor teacher, I made many, many referrals to this excellent agency that they're speaking about, and I certainly don't question the content, but I do indeed question the location, because it's situated smack dab in the middle of the worst crime-ridden areas in Contra Costa County. And my question is, since it is indeed, you know, on rented property, the state doesn't own it. Has there ever been any thought given to moving it to a more friendly area?
Well, this is Samir. I'm going to field this question. First of all, to answer the first part of your question, unfortunately, the case is many of our students are on SSI, and that's not a whole lot of money, and that doesn't allow for people to move into very affluent areas. And so this is very much real life. And because chances are you're not going to be able to land a nice place in the Bay Area on SSI. So we teach the areas not to go to, or the you have to be cautious of, the safer areas. So you kind of have to take it with a grain of salt because San Pablo is, maybe it's not the greatest area in the world, but our community is very close-knit. And our students feel safe out on the streets because they're walking it and they're doing it every day. And nobody is instilling fear into their hearts. As for the other part of the question, we are doing very aggressive fundraising, and we are currently kicking around the idea of getting a building. But we will probably stay in the East Bay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm very sorry. I know there are other people that have questions, but we do have to get on. I want to thank you very, very much, all of you, for that great presentation. Thank you very much. Okay, I am very excited, and I want to thank Dan Kaiser for bringing this lady to our attention. I'm very excited about our next presenter. Cecilia von Beroldingen, she, after moving at an early age from eastern Pennsylvania, grew up in Burbank. Yeah, I thought some of you might like that. She graduated from UC Santa Cruz in 1972 with a degree in biology with honors. I have to say, I'm not going to read her whole bio, but I had to highlight this little part. She says that while there, she had her red 65 Mustang, which would be a classic. I bet you wish you still owned that.
Yes, I do.
You do, see? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She did, see? And while there, she picked up some hitchhiker named Linton, who subsequently married her, and they are still married today. Now, that is great. That is great. Okay. She went on to receive a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon in 1978 and did postdoctoral work at Oregon State and the research of Scripps Clinic in La Jolla. While attending, Okay. In the late 1980s, she joined the forensic science program at UC Berkeley and was in on the ground floor of the new exciting science of forensic DNA testing. In 1989, Cecilia and her family moved to Oregon, where she took a position at the Oregon State Police Forensics Laboratory in Portland. She is a forensic scientist specializing in the field of DNA testing. Currently, she is the director of the California Criminalistic Institute in Sacramento, working for the Department of Justice. This institute provides training in forensic scientists to people in California's organized crime labs. Now, just as an aside to this organization, although it's a very impressive aside, in 1990, just 6 months after moving to Oregon, Cecilia lost much of her vision as a result of a benign brain tumor. Because she had partial vision, albeit very limited, Cecilia did not let anything stop her, and obviously she continued on with her outstanding career. So I hope you're as excited as I am to hear about the work that Cecilia does. So let's hear it for Cecilia von Beroldingen.
So much. I just wanted to let everyone know that it's a great pleasure for me to come here and address your group, and I especially want to thank Dan for inviting me here to give this presentation. I've been in the field of forensic DNA testing for almost 20 years now, and for much of that time, 16 years, I have been severely visually impaired. My husband and I moved up to Oregon in late 1989 to start working for the Oregon State Police in their forensic lab in Portland. My husband is also a forensic scientist. We decided to move back to Oregon, where I had done my graduate work, because we had two young children at the time. My daughter Katie was about a year old, and my son Nick was four.
And we thought, well, Oregon would be a great place to raise these kids. And we were both excited about our new careers with the Oregon State Police and their forensic lab. And I was particularly excited because I was going to start up the DNA testing program for the Oregon State Police. Well, much to my surprise, I went to get my Oregon driver's license, and although I passed the test, I noticed that my vision wasn't quite what I expected it to be, and I wore contact lenses at the time. So I immediately said, okay, I'll go see the ophthalmologist, and the ophthalmologist was not able to correct my vision, and he suggested, well, stop wearing your contact lenses for a couple of weeks and come back. A couple of weeks later, I went back, and he did more extensive testing, and after which he said, I need to refer you to a neuro-ophthalmologist because something is going on here, and I think you really need to see a specialist. Well, the next week, I saw the neuro-ophthalmologist, and after more extensive testing, followed by an MRI, I discovered that I had a brain tumor. Fortunately, it was a benign brain tumor, but by benign, that just means it grows slowly. This one apparently had been growing for quite some time, slowly, and had wrapped around both of my optic nerves and was potentially endangering the arteries in my brain. So I needed to have neurosurgery. Going into neurosurgery, the surgeon told me that, well, he could go in there. There's a chance that if he removed the tumor, I could get much of my vision back. But if it were a malignant tumor, he was just going to close everything up because there probably wasn't much to do. So that was pretty daunting news to hear before I went into this operation. Well, the operation lasted for about 6 hours. Side effect of the operation was that it was so extensive they had to snip my olfactory nerve in order to lift up the front portion of my brain to get in and remove all of the tumor tissue. So I was down my olfactory sense too. I came out of the operation and realized that I couldn't see very well at all. And it didn't get any better. I was essentially blind out of my left eye and had a very small, patchy field of vision that extended from about 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock in my right eye. I went home. Fortunately, my colleagues at the Oregon State Police donated vacation time, so I was able to spend several months recovering. And I had just begun to have contact with the Oregon Commission for the Blind to set up my orientation and mobility training and my rehabilitation when I received a notice from the Oregon State Police saying that summoning me to a meeting with the deputy superintendent to explain to him why I shouldn't be terminated. So, why I should not be terminated. So I went to this meeting, and the result of the meeting was that I was given 6 months to demonstrate to my employer, the Oregon State Police, that I was able to satisfy the essential job functions for which I was hired. Well, I had spent more than 20 years preparing for this career, and I had invested a lot of time, and I'm a little stubborn, as my husband will attest. And I said, I'm going to make this work. So with the great help of a large number of people at the Oregon Commission for the Blind, they came to my assistance. We had a meeting with people from the Oregon State Police. They outlined to the Oregon State Police the training I would need, the rehabilitation training, the orientation and mobility training that I would need to come back to do my work. And for 6 months, I underwent intensive rehabilitation training. The Oregon Commission for the Blind sent a couple of their people to the lab to walk through and to find out exactly what I needed to do, and they devised a way to do just about everything. My job involves doing a lot of reading of scientific literature. They provided me with a CCTV and with a computer software that allowed me to scan books. Part of my job requirement was to still work in the lab, so a specialist in low vision came out to the lab and fitted me with a pair of magnifying spectacles that allowed me to do my lab work. And at the end of 6 months, my supervisor at the Oregon State Police said, okay, you proved to us that you can do your job. So I got... But that was just the beginning, because my job was... I was the technical leader of the DNA section, and I was also expected to do some casework and to testify. And over the years, I did much less work in the lab and started to manage people. But one of the first things I had to do shortly after losing my vision was to testify in a very high-profile murder case in the state of Washington. Because of my work in California at Berkeley, I was considered an expert in DNA testing, and I was asked to testify for the prosecution in an admissibility hearing in Washington. The case involved the brutal bludgeoning to death of an 11-year-old girl. And it was a very important case. I should point out that as a forensic scientist, we're exposed to lots of nasty crimes. But as a scientist, you try to divorce yourself from the emotion so that you can concentrate on doing an unbiased analysis of the data and the situation. So I went up there to testify, and this was the first time I had testified since losing my vision, and only the second time I had testified. And this was a very litigious case. I arrived in the courtroom with the prosecutor and noticed that the defense attorney was loading slides into a carousel. And I thought, what's going on here? So I said, is he going to show slides to me? Because I won't be able to see them. And the prosecutor said, oh, don't worry. He's just trying to rattle you. So I got up on the stand and went through my direct examination. And for the cross-examination, the defense attorney started asking questions. And actually, he didn't show the slides. But what he did do was draw things on the easel and ask me questions. And I repeatedly had to say to him, counselor, I can't see what you're drawing. If you could explain to me what you're drawing, I would happily answer the question. So this went on for about a half an hour, and I think the defense attorney realized that he was annoying the judge. So he kind of backed off on that testimony, or that line of asking me questions. And at the end of the day, I was done. And thankfully, the evidence was admitted, and I had to go back and testify in the trial. And the individual was convicted of the murder and was actually sentenced to death, because it was a very brutal crime. And the state of Washington did evoke the capital punishment. Several months later, I was working in our lab, and I received in my mail a card, which was from, I believe, Idaho or Montana, and it was from an individual by the name of Holton. And one of my best friends in graduate school was a lady by the name of B. Holton, and I thought, oh, this is B writing me a note. And I happily opened it, and when someone read the contents of the card to me, it turned out to be a thank you note from the parents of the young girl who had died in this case. And it just reinforced for me, and you know, that wasn't the first time and certainly wasn't the last time, how important my job was, and just made me want to work harder. I did actually testify quite a lot in the work that I did on my own in the laboratory, and strangely enough, there was no contest from the defense or any questions asked to me about why I could do this work when I was so visually impaired. And I think, in part, they may not have recognized that I was blind, because was able to make it to the stand with minimal assistance, and then I guess I testified with enough confidence that they, you know, really didn't know that I was blind. But in 1994, I got my first guide dog, Cola, and that was the beginning of a really wonderful period of time for me. I was actually involved in another very high-profile murder case in Oregon when I went down to San Rafael to train with Cola. And about halfway through my training, I was summoned back to testify in an admissibility hearing with regard to this crime. And I remember talking to my instructor at GDB, and I said to her, Margie, I need to fly back to Oregon because I have to testify in a trial. And she said, I'm not sure we can allow you to do that. So I explained to her that if I didn't go back and testify, that they would arrest me if I went back to Oregon. But anyway, they gave me dispensation to go up and testify in an admissibility hearing. And then I came back to guide dogs, graduated with Cola, and my first day back in Oregon on the job, I had to go testify in this high-profile murder case. It was a very interesting case. The man was accused of murdering his estranged wife. He had enticed her to meet him at a gas station in the wee hours of the morning. The gas station was adjacent to a highway in Oregon. He apparently beat her to death and then pushed her car onto the highway, hoping that a car would run into it and any of the injuries that were discovered would be attributed to an accident. Well, somebody found the car before it was involved in the accident, and it was obviously a foul event. Unfortunately, at the time, the district attorney didn't think that there was enough evidence to bring this guy to trial. But the family of the victim was so outraged that they hired private investigators. And it was sort of the reverse of the O.J. Simpson trial. There was a civil hearing in which he was convicted of wrongful death. And the evidence that was uncovered by the private investigators was used by the district attorney's office in Oregon to prosecute him criminally for the murder. And I ended up doing some testing of hairs that were found on the lady's body, which implicated him in the crime, and so I had to testify in the case. So here I walked into the trial, the courtroom, with my brand new guide dog. It was a trial by fire. The defendant insisted that he act as his own attorney. When it got to the point where he was going to be examining me on the DNA evidence, he had requested from the judge that he be allowed to bring in another defense attorney to examine me. And the judge said, nope, you signed up for being your own attorney, so you're going to examine this witness. And so he was I went through the direct examination and explained the results of my testing, and I was cross-examined by Mr. Cunningham. The individual was Brad Cunningham, and he was, by all accounts, a very smooth character, and his, you know, cross-examination was very smooth. Unbeknownst to me, there was an author in the courtroom, a lady by the name of Ann Rule, who writes books about prominent criminal cases. And she was there, and she met with me after my testimony, and she was just, you know, really pleased to talk to me, and she told me who she was and that she was here to write a book on the case. And a book eventually did come out about a year later called Death by Sunset, or Death on Sunset. It was on the Sunset Highway that the murder occurred. And I was in the book, as was Cola. She described Cola as a golden retriever. Cola was a yellow lab, but that was okay. And there were words to the effect in the book that Cola was a very highly trained dog, but when she heard the mellifluous tones of Brad Cunningham, she growled very low, which she didn't do. But I guess, for poetic license, that's fine. So that was one of my first experiences in court with Cola. Actually, when I had the guide dog, I think people realized that I actually was blind, and it became more of an issue in court. In fact, I was testifying as the DNA technical leader. I had not done the work in the case. One of my analysts who was working for me did the work, but I had to testify in a trial to support the procedures and protocols and the quality assurance of our DNA testing in the Oregon State Police, because I had written the protocols and the quality assurance manual and so on and so forth. Surprisingly, I found out that in the opening arguments, the defense had made a big deal about the fact that I was blind and I was the technical leader, and how could this work be trusted because the technical leader for the Oregon State Police was blind. Okay, so with that preface, I went to court and testified. Typically, there's a direct examination, and then I answered questions from the prosecutor about how our system was set up and our quality assurance measures, et cetera, et cetera. And then I was cross-examined by the defense attorney. And he just pointedly asked me a lot of questions about the lab, which, of course, I knew the answers to. I mean, I was an expert in my field, so I wasn't really terribly intimidated by the questions. And then he started waving around a document, and he said, okay, this is the Technical Working Group and DNA Analysis Methods Quality Assurance Guidelines. Are you familiar with these? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, are you familiar with Standard 9.1? And I said, yes, I think I am. And he said, well, isn't it true that Standard 9.1 says da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da? And I looked at him and I said, no, I don't think so. And he looked kind of puzzled. And so I turned to the judge and I said, I have a copy of those guidelines in my briefcase. Is it okay if I pull them out? And the judge said, yeah, of course. So I pulled them out and I got out my handheld magnifier and I flipped to section 9.1 and I read to the defense attorney what guideline 9.1 was. And he looked even more perplexed. And he said, Judge, may I approach the witness? And judge said, okay. And he came up, and I handed him my document, and he looked at it. And then he handed me his document, and I looked at it, and I said, oh, those are the 1988 standards. The newest standards are the 1995 standards. And at that point, the defense attorney said, no more questions. So, fortunately, as it's not usually the case, but I was allowed to remain in the courtroom for the remainder of the case, so I got to hear the rest of the trial. I got to listen to the closing arguments, and in the closing arguments, the defense did not say one word about the fact that I was blind. And during the whole proceeding of the afternoon of being in the courtroom, I was sitting in the first row of seats of the observers, and periodically the judge would call a recess, and he would go out, and he'd come back in, and the bailiff would rise and say, all rise, and everyone in the courtroom would rise, and Cola would rise, and we'd all sit down. And the very last time he came into the courtroom that afternoon before giving his instructions to the jury, the bailiff said, all rise, and I stood up, Cola stood up, and I heard the judge say, huh, even the dog rises. So, but that didn't end my adventures in court with Cola. Just a couple of months later, I had to testify in the same courthouse. Again, there was an admissibility hearing concerning a brutal murder of two young men. They were brothers, I believe, who were stabbed to death in their sleeping bags on the banks of the Willamette River. and an analyst in our lab did the testing in the case. A leather jacket from the suspect was recovered, and there weren't any apparent bloodstains on the jacket. But my analyst was able to do some testing and to find some very small bloodstains, which we did DNA testing on, and it came back to a type that was the same as the victims in the case. So that was the evidence, the DNA evidence in the case. As is usual with high-profile murder cases, the defense attempted to get the evidence eliminated from being presented to the jury, and they filed a number of motions. One motion was that the evidence was improperly collected, and they had all these reasons why it was improperly collected. They said that the DNA testing was invalid and unreliable, so they wanted the DNA evidence to be omitted. And then finally, they said, and we want Dr. von Berlden-Dingen's dog to be prohibited from entering the courtroom because it would make the jury more sympathetic to her testimony. Well, I wasn't there at the time, but the story from the prosecutor in the case was that when these motions were delivered to the judge, he said, "Gentlemen, back to my office." They went back to his chambers, and he looked at the defense attorney and said, "Are you serious about this one?" And the defense attorney, thinking better, said, "No, I guess not." So Cole and I did, in fact, testify in the admissibility hearing. Well, she didn't testify. She just kind of curled up beside me as I was testifying. And we also ended up testifying in the trial. And I have to admit that there may be a little bit of truth to the defense attorney's claim, because as the people in my lab who were observing my testimony remarked to me afterwards, they said, "Well, you know, when you got into the witness stand with Cola, all of the jurors started smiling and nodding." And so in any event, we had some adventures. I had testified in another case in Portland. DNA testing at that time went through a lot of admissibility hearings because it was such powerful evidence that the defense, if they had their druthers, would rather have that evidence not presented to a jury. And so I was testifying in another court case. It was an admissibility hearing. I testified rather lengthily for one afternoon, and it was getting towards the end of the afternoon. It was clear that I was going to come back and complete my testimony the next day. So the judge said to me, "Would it be possible for you to come back tomorrow morning?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And then he leant down and patted Cola and said, "But you could leave your dog behind." So anyway, I had quite the career in Oregon. I think I testified California, quite a bit in Oregon, also in Washington, and in the state of Alaska. And in 2000, I got a job offer from the California Department of Justice to come down to be an assistant lab director in their DNA laboratory in the Bay Area. And it was a very attractive offer. It was I'm always up for a challenge, so I decided, okay, I can move on and do something new and different. My children by that time were a little bit older. My son was just finishing high school, and my husband and I decided that he would stay up in Oregon for a couple of years until my son completed high school. So I came down to California on my own and proceeded to get an apartment in Davis, where I had several friends. And for just over 2 years, I commuted from Davis to the Bay Area on Amtrak, walked to our lab, which was initially in Berkeley, and then it was moved to Richmond. But I worked down there for 2 years on my own, and it was a great experience. My position with our DNA lab was that I was initially hired to come down and to teach a new group of DNA analysts who would be working on what was called the Cold Hit Grant. And this was a grant that California Crime Labs had for a period of 5 years where they would go back and work unsolved cases that did not have a suspect, primarily sexual assault cases and homicides. And we could develop DNA profiles from the perpetrators in these cases and then search it against the state's convicted offender DNA index to see if we could solve the crimes. And so I trained these individuals and then supervised their casework for about a year before I was promoted to be the director in charge of method development and training at the DNA laboratory. By that time, my husband had accepted a job with the California Department of Justice, also working in the DNA laboratory. He is currently the manager of the convicted offender DNA database, so he's the guy that's responsible for helping solve these cases, because his group is the one that searches the convicted offender database and can match a perpetrator from an unsolved case to an individual who has been convicted of another crime. So I think we have about 2,000 cold hits now, which is great. It has really solved a lot of crimes that for which the perpetrator would have gone unknown had it not been for DNA testing. Just recently, I shortened my commute. My husband and I live in Davis. And I took a job with the California Criminalistics Institute here in Sacramento. California Criminalistics Institute is also under the California Department of Justice. Criminalistics, by the way, is just another term for forensic science. And what we do at the Institute is to provide training to all forensic scientists throughout the state of California in all of the various forensic disciplines, not only DNA testing, but firearms examination, trace evidence examination, drug testing, et cetera, et cetera. We also provide expertise to California's crime labs and kind of serve as the experts in forensic science to legislators and to the Attorney General's office. So it's a different job for me. I don't testify anymore, but it's very rewarding. I'm still very much involved in training. I teach a lot of our DNA classes. It's forensic science is my love and my passion. And so I'm very grateful for, in particular, to all of the people at the Oregon Commission for the Blind who assisted me in getting through this really rough period of my life and enabled me to pursue the career that I wanted to pursue. And thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I am sure that that will create a number of questions, but I'm going to greatly disappoint a lot of people, I suspect, because we are very much behind schedule. But that was just outstanding. Thank you for coming. Let's hear it one more time for Cecilia. Okay. For our last presenter of the day, we have a very interesting topic, I think. Something that I want to thank Margie Donovan for helping us to pursue. It's a topic that we have been interested in for quite a while, and we finally have a chance to hear a little about it today. We have with us today the acting warden of Folsom Prison, Mr. Walter Kramer. Thank you, Walter. Thank you. I am terribly sorry. It's Matthew Kramer, and I am already off to a bad start.
No problem.
But I don't want to be sentenced for that.
Well, we do want to take your DNA, though. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here with this group today, and I would like to rush through a couple of about three set topics and give you folks an opportunity to ask a couple of questions because this is a wide range of issues that we do deal with in the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. This is such a small world because listening a great opportunity to meet Cecilia, and I have worked with Cecilia's husband on the convicted felon DNA program that we had, which I have to say is one of the more successful programs the state has implemented, which has resulted, as mentioned, in over 2,000 convictions in which we have to date. And that is an important one of the priority programs that we do in the prison system. Before it was only felons with violent crimes were actually DNA tested. The law was recently expanded where nearly all convicted felons are DNA tested, which has greatly enhanced the conviction rate for those that otherwise would have probably gone undetected. What I wanted to talk today briefly, what I was asked to talk about, is the what happens when a person with a disability enters into the prison system. I've been in the system now for about 30 years, 20 years out actually working in prisons, mostly in management, in a management capacity. I was up in Susanville at High Desert State Prison, Sierra Conservation Center, which is out in the Sonora-Jamestown area, as the warden when I was first appointed a warden back in 1996, and then recently, about within the last year, transferred down to Folsom State Prison, take over and actually make some major mission changes at Folsom Prison. When I first started in the prison system back in the 80s, an inmate came into the system. What we did is we took one or two other inmates that we had that we were kind of like a trustee type system, and we assigned that inmate to the inmate with a disability, and we told that inmate to take care of him. See that he gets fed, see that he gets what he needs, and if anything happens to him, we're going to take it out on you. And that was basically the way the system worked until about 1995. In 1995, the department established what we call the Disability Placement Plan. The goal of this program, which had been implemented, lays out a system for housing and programming inmates with a disability, and it specializes. What we've done is we've established 10 prisons, one of the prisons being a female prison, throughout the state that are specifically designed with placement needs. And depending upon the type of disability, that is where the individual will be assigned. The plan, and this has been gone through the court system, so it is actually more than a plan. This is a program that we've agreed upon with the courts and the legislature and implement within the department. We divide it into four categories. We have what we call the permanent mobility impairments, hearing impairments, speech impairments, and visual impairments. And in total, we have 6,500 inmates in the system that meet one of those four impairments. In just the visual impairment, we have approximately 1,000 inmates with a visual impairment, 230 which are total with a total blindness that we have that we're dealing with. What the department does is we identify, we're calling our reception centers, we do thorough medical checks, and those individuals with a placement need are designated, classified, and tracked as they go through their incarceration period. We have, like I was saying, we have in the prisons, we have definite or specific physical physical changes or modifications that have been made in order to house inmates. For example, they will always be on a tiered, if they have a tier, they will always have a lower tier. They will be on the first floor. They will have a lower bunk. We have cells with wider cell doors that have been designed. Then we have different hearing or noise apparatus for warnings, lights, telephone systems that have also been installed in those designated prisons for those that have an impairment. One of the other things we do is we have inmates wear a yellow vest. If they're one of the 6,500 inmates, they will wear a yellow vest when they are out of their cell, if they're on the yard or out of their cell. And this is done for a variety of reasons. Obvious ones for staff identification. In addition to wearing the vest, all staff in the unit have a listing of those inmates and the type of impairment that they may have. This is in case there is some type of an emergency situation. These are the first inmates that the staff respond to see that their needs are met, if they need to get out of the building for some reason, if there's some kind of a riot or an incident. We do not want these inmates to somehow get involved or not know what has taken place. So we have staff designated to go to where these inmates are, and they are given a first priority in making sure that what happens to these inmates in that situation. Let me get through a couple of issues, and then I'll take questions, because I would like to get questions, have you folks an opportunity to ask any questions. So this is one of the systems that we do use to make sure that there are not any that there's not any problems as far as riots, as far as evacuations. As you know, sometimes if we have an incident on the yard, if we have any kind of a riot situation, we have a call. As alarm goes off, all inmates have to get down. They have to get down into a prone position immediately. Or there is somebody with a Mini 14 that is going to be aiming it at them to make sure that they stop and get down. That is one of the reasons why we have the vests on them as well, so all staff know, aren't aware, that there's a special need here that we need to address and accommodate. We also try to set up special programs, special education, and vocational programs, in addition to the voice, the TDD and TDD voice relay systems, in addition to special property. Inmates that have impairments are authorized whatever needs that they have from a medical perspective that they can keep with them in their cells and as they go about their daily activities and programming in the prison. We do work, and I'm also glad to see Catherine Campisi here today, because we have worked with her and Department of Rehabilitation on special programs within the prison. I think, unfortunately, like the other 170,000 inmates that we have in the system, we have those we're trying to establish more of a rehabilitation mode. We're trying to establish more programs, more vocations. And unfortunately, it's pretty percentagely among those that are in the system, the 6,500 with the impairments, as in the population, about 70 to 80% of that group, as the general population, has some type of a substance abuse, drug, alcohol, substance abuse program, which has been in part for them being and led to them being into the system, incarcerated in the system. So one of the big pushes we're trying to do is establish more drug rehab type programs for those individuals and make it available for those individuals as well. The other part that I wanted to talk about real quickly is one of the things we're very proud of at Folsom Prison. We have the visually impaired program and project that has been established at Folsom Prison. Thank you. This was established back in 1989, and it is in collaboration with the Folsom City Lions Club, Don Ringer and his group, which have contributed thousands of dollars to buy special equipment needs that we could know that we would not be able to get within the state budget, going through the state budget plan. And what we are able to do is work in collaboration with not only the Department of Rehab, but the Department of Education. And we do Braille transcription. We do tactile and what we call thermal form maps and charts, textbooks for geographic locations, for maps around the schools. So students come in, they can have this type of a mapping system is available. We do closed captioning. We do media presentation, books, tapes, digital recording. We do a lot of document conversion. This takes standard office equipment, puts it in an electronic computer format. We do eyeglass analysis and distribution. At Folsom, we take in and collect old eyeglasses. These are then cleaned, marked, and sent not only within the United States, but to countries like China, Thailand, and South America. We've done over $200,000 worth of these eyeglasses that we have shipped out, and this is all done free of charge. In the Department of Education, we talked about the Braille textbooks that have done. We've done over $50,000 worth of books for the Department of Education. In the community college, we've done the same thing, including the maps that we've produced, which they have calculated at a savings of over $350,000. We've done work for the House of the Blind in Kentucky, in which we've provided Braille publications. We have also done, I'm going to mispronounce this, Jernigan Library, thank you, which we have done for children. We've done translated children's books, and this is done. And we've also done special projects for individuals that could not afford or would not have the ability to get material translated for them that we do on a special request at the prison. And I'll admit, this is one of the programs that the inmates, we have about 20 inmates that work in this program, and they are very, very dedicated to this project. We've had about 10 inmates that have paroled out, and of the 10 inmates that have paroled out, not one of them has come back to prison, and they all... thank you. And they all have got jobs in this area, in this program area, working for either rehab or Braille projects. But one of the other areas that I'm not so proud of, and that is the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation's ability to go out and hire folks that do have disabilities. It is something that we've tried, it's something we've made some attempts, but there's something in the prison system that is just kind of this macho thing, and it's really difficult to break that down and get into areas where we can expand as you, I listened to some of the programs earlier today, and it's really something we do have to do a better job on working on providing employment opportunities. At Folsom, we have gone out, I've had meetings with Pride Industries. We've identified a number of areas that I believe that we can benefit by having more employees out with disabilities that can perform a wide variety of administrative programs. In a prison, like Folsom Prison, about 60% of the staff are peace officers, correctional. The other 40% of about 1,000 or 400 employees, we perform just a whole variety of administrative functions. We're like a small city, and we have every function. We have a school, we have a hospital, we have all the maintenance functions, we have accounting, we have procurement, we have our own post office. A lot of these functions could be done, administrative functions could be done by folks with disabilities, and that's one of the things we're trying to make a bigger push on, is to expand that employment opportunities. So, thank you for the opportunity to be here. There was a question in the back. Does any? Possibly I answered it. One of the few times I've been successful.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Yeah, get to a mic or raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you somehow.
Yes, ma'am.
Mitch Pomerantz works for the city of Los Angeles, and he asked me to ask you. He said that he had heard in the Los Angeles prison system they had to wear signs that said that they were blind. Now, I will tell him about the yellow vests, but is it necessary for them to wear signs?
I believe it's not. It's a yellow vest is what we have for the 6,200 inmates is a yellow vest.
Right. I'll tell him. And the other thing is, Bob Smith is an old friend of mine, and he wanted everybody to know that project has Braille, the visitor's handbook and the prisoner's rights handbook and all sorts of other things that would be helpful to blind persons in prison and to their families.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Okay, well, people have to make their way to a mic.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Rayanne Myers. My question has to do with medical care. I know that the prison system has had difficulty in keeping quality physicians. Has there been any progress in that area?
What we've done now is the department's medical care program is now under federal court receivership. The federal judge, the judge out of the Ninth Circuit Court, has established a monitor. The monitor is going to be coming in fact, next week, and the monitor will be taking over the medical section, the medical department within the prison system. So we're all waiting to see how this is going to work, how this is going to play out. I think part of the problems that we've had in the past is with the pay system, we've ran up to 50% of our medical positions we have not been able to fill. One is pay, and one, quite frankly, is a lot of medical staff do not want to come to work in the prison system. And that's with that in mind, one of the first things that the court did even before the monitor came in was to increase the pay of the medical staff by about 18 to 25%. Since then, well, get your application in. Since then, we've been able to lower the number of vacancies, but I'll admit we still are plagued with substantial problems in the medical area. One of the problems we have is the inmates with the longer term sentence, with three strikes, indeterminate sentence, we are getting a far older inmate population. When I came into the system, the average age was about 24. It's now up to 37 as being the average age. And we're also getting a bifurcated population. We're getting the young kids that are coming in, that are coming into the system, and then we're getting the older group that's getting up into the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. The inmate, when they hit near 50 years old, cost $75,000 a year to have that inmate in the system, as opposed to an average of about 25 to 30 for the average inmate coming into the system. As you get into the hospice, as you get into the types of geriatric care that needs to be provided, just with age alone. The other part of the problem is we're having more and more inmates coming in with the effects of the drug problem. And they're coming in with permanent damage. They're coming in with a lot of dental or no teeth at all. They're coming in needing with serious damage due to overuse of drugs that is also causing a burden on the medical system. And when some of these drugs now that they're getting aren't the type that you can just get out of their system once they get into the prison and go through the reception. By the time they got into the prison, in the old days, they'd gone through some kind of a detox, and it was pretty much out of their system. Now they're suffering the psychological, and we see the psychiatric impact of these drugs on these individuals, and thank God they're in prison. And not, as you probably mentioned, if you saw the news, out what's happening even out on the streets out here, I think we're getting to see, unfortunately, more of that crime out on the streets, as we've had to deal with in the prison system with the psychiatric, the bipolar type attitude that we're seeing more and more of, which has been either directly or indirectly related to a drug treatment, to drug overuse. I'm sorry.
Okay, do we have any other questions?
Yes, one more.
Okay, I'm going to ask one, and then I'm going to, is it David?
Yes.
Okay, you'll be next. Do the blind and visually impaired prisoners have access to reading materials in formats that they can use, such as cassettes and materials in those formats?
And we are providing, we would like to have more. We do have some, and we do have some programs available. And in fact, we're trying, that's one of the priorities we're trying to do in Folsom Prison, is to have more Braille and more cassette-type material available. But it is an area that we do need to have more of as that prison population, portion of the prison population increases.
Could you review your statistic one more time of your 6,500 disabled inmates? How many are visually impaired, and you gave a figure of how many were totally blind?
Approximately 1,000. And right today, currently in the system, we have approximately 1,000 inmates with a visual impairment. Approximately 250 are totally blind.
Thank you.
David?
Okay.
Whoa. David's next.
I have just a question. For those folks who are visually impaired, blind, or low vision, who do not go to those programs where they're doing Braille, or they're not doing recording, or doing the Braille maps, and they leave prison, what happens to those folks? Where do they go? And you mentioned Catherine Campisi. When they parole out, do you track them still? Do you help them with getting back into society? That's the question I had.
That's good. Thank you. The first part to your question is, we try to provide to the extent we have, and I'll first say we do not provide at all. We do not have the facilities. I don't think the department anticipated, again, that we would have that many inmates that would come into the system as we have. So what percent are actually in programming and have the Braille available? I cannot honestly answer that question. But we are trying to meet that need, but what the exact percent is at this point. If it's consistent with what the last time I checked, we're probably about 40 to 50% of those inmates that have the abilities are actually in a program, are actually attending some kind of VOC or educational program. What we're trying to do now is we have parole agents that are coming, they're actually assigned to the prison system. Up at Jamestown, we had 6 parole agents assigned to the prison system. At Folsom, we have 4. And what we do is we take, as the inmates parole out, we assign them, we hook them into the parole agent that between the parole office at the prison and the parole agents that's going to be working with them on the street. We then try to identify what needs they have and what type of program or what kind of job opportunities or skills or mental or medical facilities that would help them to actually do a better job of placing them. Right now, as you're probably aware, we have about a 70% recidivism rate, and that recidivism rate is about the same with the impaired as we have with the general population. So that's something where we recognize, the state legislature, the governor recognizes as a problem, and that we do need to put more programming and more ties to parole and to assisting the inmates when they do get out on parole to keep them from just coming right back into the system.
Okay, we have time for just 2 more. Well, I think there was and Margie's going to be the second, but I think there was a woman in the back who...
I have the microphone.
Yeah. if the woman in the back doesn't have the mic, then Margie, go right
ahead. Okay, then we'll get it to her. Thanks, Jeff. My question is kind of a broader question. How do the blind and visually impaired veterans, Jesus, we know where I work, inmates get access to things such as computers? How do they navigate around the prison since we know they're not allowed to have canes? So kind of a broader programmatic access I'm curious to hear about. And along with that, I'm quite surprised that the prison system has not partnership with the Braille and Talking Book Library, which has an endless supply of equipment and books in accessible formats. So can you address those things?
Yes, on the navigating around the prisons, actually, they are allowed canes.
Oh, they are?
Some inmates are allowed canes, and they do have what we have designated areas within the facilities that where they can go to the program, where they can go to school, where they can go to the dining hall. So there are designated paths, as we call them, that were designed within the prisons that were set up and established for the PARP. So we do have that. We do have the facilities available for them. And why we haven't hooked up with that group or not, I'm not sure, but I'd like to talk to you afterwards or talk to you at a later time about how we can get and receive more material along that line. That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for one more and we'll get a mic to someone if you want to know who you are.
I got the mic. This
okay,
is Pamela.
You're it.
Okay, my question deals with also a medical issue of preventing some of your disabilities, especially like with visual impairment of your inmate population, which has got to reflect at least some of the population out here. We have an epidemic of diabetes, and diabetes can lead to many very serious and devastating complications, including dialysis, gastroparesis, and a lot of neuropathy, and where they'd be in wheelchairs. What are you doing to help control blood glucose of your diabetic population, and also with meal planning, as far as if you eat a meal heavy in carbohydrates, you're automatically going to raise blood sugars, which will in turn lead to these complications. I thank you.
Well, thank you for the question, and you're absolutely right. Just as the general population, that is a significant problem, medical problem within the inmate population. And we have, when an inmate comes into the system, they go through an extensive medical check. Dialysis is one of the services that we do provide that has to be provided and is provided. In order to do the prevention, we have the dietary. We have, I think about five, I'm going to guess about 5 to 6 years ago, in conjunction with the courts, we agreed upon a special, more of what we call a heart-healthy dietary plan. When an inmate, if you into a prison system, when an inmate goes to the end of the prison for a meal, they do not have a choice, as they did years ago when they go through. We have what we call a blind feeding line. And the way that works is there is a spot that the inmate goes to the counter and a meal is passed, a tray is passed to that inmate. The folks do not have a choice, and they have to get what is medically provided on that line. Now, that has been with some controversy. Well, it has certain health benefits to it. You get inmates that come right off the streets, and they're used to a certain high carbohydrate diet, and they get into the prison system, and we give them this tray, and it has a lot of broccoli on it. This is probably the first time that some of these inmates have ever seen, let alone eaten, broccoli. And they don't know what are we trying to do to them. And so this has been an issue, but it is part of the program, sort of the plan that we do have on hopefully dealing with diabetes and other types of Yes, yes, they are given blood tests, extensive blood testing.
All right, into the system. I'm going to have to draw the session to a close. We really thank Mr. Kramer for an excellent presentation. Thanks to all of our presenters. Remember, tonight's banquet, there will be tickets available for our scholarship raffle at the banquet. So will you be there or be square? And we will see you this evening. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.